Welcome to SILRAP Podcasts. You are about to listen to a service of the Center for International Law Research and Policy.
Well, thank you for the kind introduction. I want to talk about law's representational power. I will first make some comments on conceptual nature and regarding theory, then I will provide some empirical data, and then I will make some cautionary comments afterwards. Given the atrocities committed in the 20th century, it is almost amazing when Martha Minow, a legal scholar at Harvard, says that the remarkable thing about the 20th century is not so much the atrocities, because many other centuries can compete with that distinction, but the remarkable thing is that it is the first century in which humankind has systematically tried to build up institutions to prevent or to respond to mass violence. And of course, there are truth commissions, there are vetting procedures, there are reparation programs, and there are criminal justice responses. Catherine Sicking, good friend and former colleague of mine at Minnesota, speaks even about a justice cascade, a massive increase in criminal prosecution against human rights perpetrators. Research has recently turned to not just thinking about the conditions of a justice cascade, but thinking about the consequences. And we, of course, we have, as in all debates, skeptics and we have optimists. Snyder and Vinjamuri are among the skeptics who say that the threat of criminal justice intervention often may prolong dictatorship atrocities, because the conflicting sides are not willing to give up their position of power if they are threatened with criminal prosecution. And then there are optimists, and the optimists have the advantage of having gathered quite powerful data sets. Hiran Joe and Beth Simmons, for example, have studied in quite systematic analyses the impact of ICC prosecutions on perpetration by governments and by rebel forces. And they find that with each additional prosecution, the risk of perpetration actually declines. So they come up with quite optimistic conclusions. Catherine Sicking, analyzing some 200 transitional justice situations, also says that the human rights record in countries improves after prosecutions have been conducted, and that the success is larger in situations where trials were combined with truth commissions, a point to which I will return. Something that remains open in many of these assessments is a black box that's placed somewhere between institutional interventions and outcomes. Scholars struggle to explain potential improvements or improvements that they measure, but for which they don't provide a clear causal analysis. So there is a black box, and intuitively, most scholars fill this black box with a simple rational choice deterrence argument. They say that in light of prosecution, future generations of officers and political and military leaders will be cautious to repeat actions for which their predecessors were punished. I am not totally unsympathetic to this argument, but I think it is a limited argument, and it must be supplemented by a cultural argument, by an argument that deals with the representational or narrative, if you want, power of international human rights trials. Even Hiran Joe and Beth Simmons and Catherine Sickings are somewhat uncertain about their deterrence argument. Sicking, for example, ends her chapter on the consequences of criminal justice prosecution by saying, "We can't yet sort out clearly whether trials work mainly through deterrence and punishment or through socialization and collective memory." So there is some nodding to the potential of cultural consequences of trials. Joe and Simmons say focus on deterrence too, but they also talk about social deterrence. The normative environment is critical deterrence. The ICC has stimulated normative change within civil society through its justice outreach. More research to characterize the nature of said normative change would support our point. Now, these kinds of arguments are rather in line with hope that was expressed at the time of the International Military Tribunal in Nuremberg by actors like Roosevelt and Justice Jackson. Roosevelt was determined that the question of Hitler's guilt must not be left open to future debate. The nauseating matter should be spread out on a permanent record under oath by witnesses and with all the written documents. Justice Jackson wanted to establish incredible events with credible evidence. So what these practitioners in politics and law tried to do was to write a history-writing function into criminal trials of this sort. It wasn't just about retribution, it wasn't just about deterrence, it was about the generation of a collective memory of acts, a construction that would prevent or make less likely future atrocities to occur. Now, building on this, I want to propose my central thesis, and this is that institutions of international criminal justice have the potential to practice substantial representational power. Such power has the potential of turning into symbolic power through a process of aggregation. So I clarify my terms. Representational power means the chance of an international criminal justice institution to affect collective representations and memories and to thereby impress on the global public a particular understanding of mass violence as a form of criminal violence. Symbolic power, with Bourdieu, is a tacit mode of cultural domination unfolding within everyday social habits and belief systems. I think the potential that derives from this sort of representational power is substantial. It may lead, and this is a long-term historic process, to a radical redefinition of those who are responsible for mass atrocities and mass violence. Bernard Giesen has shown in his socio-historic analyses that those actors were historically understood to be heroes, great state builders, and we are now in a historic phase in which a redefinition of such actors takes place into criminal perpetrators. And to briefly talk about my empirical research, which is summarized in the book Representing Mass Violence, it's a study on Darfur, in which, through interviews and document analysis, I studied the human rights, humanitarian, diplomacy responses to the conflict and the mediation of the narratives that were created in these competing social fields through a media analysis of a good 3,000 media reports and commentaries in newspapers from 8 countries. And we were particularly interested in the effect that judicial interventions had on the media narratives. Not surprisingly, we found different patterns of talking about Darfur across countries. For example, the willingness, we just talked about this, to use the term genocide, was way more pronounced in the United States than it was in any of the other 7 countries under investigation. We think about why this might be the case. But in addition to in cross-country differences, we found substantial differences across social fields. Comparing the human rights field with humanitarian aid field and the diplomacy field, we found distinct ways of talking about the conflict in Darfur. So here, for example, we look at the ICC charging document, which nicely illustrates the way in which the actions are talked about in terms of criminal justice. Find that Omar al-Bashir is criminally responsible as an indirect perpetrator for one, intentionally directing attacks at a civilian population as such or against individual civilians, not taking direct part in hostilities as a war crime, 2, pillage as a war crime, 3, murder as a crime against humanity, 4, extermination as a crime against humanity, etc. So a leading actor, the president of a powerful country, is here portrayed as a criminal perpetrator. Very different in the humanitarian aid field, where talk about perpetration is much more guarded, and very different also in the field of diplomacy. If you look at the history of Sudan, you have different regimes, yet mass atrocities happened in all of these regimes. So there's something systemic that the way in which the Sudanese state functions produces mass violence. And out of this very different diagnosis grows an attack against the criminal justice narrative. To see the conflict in Darfur in a way as an outcome of the criminal energy of Omar al-Bashir and his acolytes is not actually correct in terms of understanding why the Sudanese government has been engaging in these sorts of atrocities. So there are two very different ways that are just illustrated by these two different quotations. Now the question is, which interpretation of the conflict makes it into the global perception? And this simple graph is based on the analysis of more than 3,000 media reports. And we look at a number of different stages that mark intervention from UN Resolution 1564 all the way to the issuing of arrest warrants against Omar al-Bashir. What we see is that the competing narratives that are associated with the competing fields, the crime narrative, a civil war narrative, and humanitarian emergency narrative, are cited about evenly in the early stages of the process, but that the armed conflict or civil war narrative remains stable or diminishes over time. The humanitarian emergency narrative appears less and less frequently in media reports, but the criminal justice narrative, as I try to illustrate it from the charging document, appears superior, more prominently in media reporting than its competitors. That is maybe what I mean by the representational power of criminal justice interventions in human rights violations. There are sociological arguments that try to tell us why criminal justice may have such power, representation or narrative power. It's the Durkheimian tradition, which thinks about judicial interventions as a form of ritual. Jeffrey Alexander talks about the IMT as a first step toward the symbolic extension of the Holocaust, the identification with its victims. Philip Smith, whom we heard cited a moment ago, talks about criminal punishment as a didactic exercise, as a speech act in which society talks to itself about its moral identity. And this ritual power of criminal trials, of course, is supported by its legitimatory function that derives from the particular judicial procedure to which trials stick. And we could also add a Habermasian argument about the communicative processes that unfold in the setting of a trial. I develop in my paper the notion of memorial normativity, where I argue that the memories created by and representation created by criminal trials themselves have normative force that contributes in a feedback loop to the process of a human rights regime. I don't want to paint a picture that is all too rosy, and we heard this morning that our mission is to think critically about institutions, the mission of which we may welcome from the bottom of our heart. And I wrote this before I heard this appeal this morning. So here are three comments on constraints to the representational power of criminal law. The first, it has to do with the particular institutional logic. Here the argument is that it is not so much about individuals who might abuse power but the narratives constructed in narratives about atrocities here that are constructed in criminal court are very specific and limiting narratives. They focus on individuals in line with the individualizing sense of criminal law. They do not take into consideration structural forces or larger cultural patterns, like modes of anti-Semitism or other forms of racism that sociologists would deal with. The narratives are bound by legal classifications. Bystanders have no place in those classifications, even though they may be contributive to the unfolding of mass atrocities. The German word Mitläufer is actually better than the English word bystanders, those who go along with things. Law has specific evidentiary rules that are different from those of the social sciences. And law knows only a binary logic between guilty and not guilty. A social psychologist would see shades of gray, as some surviving victims also see shades of gray. And Primo Levi, for example, has written about those shades of gray. So the narrative that emerges from a trial, the representation of power may be there, but the story that is being told is a limited and limiting story. There are other constraints having to do with the political environment in which international criminal courts function, and that has already been talked about. And I've written elsewhere about the treacherous journey that such courts have to travel between the Scylla of former rationality, the Charybdis of substantive rationality. This is a tension that Max Weber highlights in his Sociology of Law. Then, of course, there's the dependency on media that might promote the judicial message through their literal reporting, the individual focus, the interest in drama, but also challenges, and these are quotations from journalists whom I interviewed in the context of my Darfur research, talking about the ICC, once said, their time is not our time. Judicial processes are long drawn, and journalists' attention and the attention span of their readers is not that long-lasting necessarily. There is need to explain the functioning of international criminal justice institutions by writers, journalists in Germany, United States, Belgium, or wherever. The ICC, of course, is only one source, and there's little availability to what the ICC produces to journalists who report from the field, in this case from Chad or Sudan. Courts, of course, are very mindful of the importance, especially international criminal courts, that their message be communicated to a worldwide public, because a worldwide public cannot sit in the courtroom as a public. And in Nuremberg, the back wall of the courtroom was taken out in order to create space for several hundred additional journalists from all over the globe. Picture on the left side. On the right side, we see the press room of the ICC, where an important decision is communicated to the press corps of the international journalistic community. Now, the story that I told and illustrated for Darfur is not a story of Darfur itself alone. There are a number of other case studies that tell us that it can be generalized. I myself have worked on the My Lai trial, the ICTY, and Nuremberg in this book, American Memories, Atrocities, and the Law. But I'm also thinking of Devin Pender's wonderful book on the Frankfurt-Auschwitz trial, on Michael Morrow's work on the Nuremberg Doctors trial, and John Hagen's work on the ICTY. Everywhere do we see the representational power of criminal law, but also the narrowness of the narrative that is created in criminal proceeding and that fades compared to accounts that are written, for example, by administrative commissions or people with or truth commissions or actors or institutions with a broader jurisdiction, if you want. So this really is my story about the representational power of criminal law. And again, the central argument is that when we think about the impact of criminal trials against human rights perpetrators, It is completely appropriate to think about the potential deterrent effect of such trials and punishments resulting from them, but focusing exclusively on those is problematic. We have to look at the cultural effects. We have to look at the representational power of criminal trials. And thank you for accompanying me through a quick run-through of my argument that I developed, of course, in greater detail in the paper that I have sent to you already. So thank you very much for your patience.
Thank you for listening. For more open access audio recordings, films, and publications, go to silrap.org.